Welcome to Untangled, a new show from WOSU where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. Pull it apart and put the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. This season, we're untangling the housing crisis. This is episode 2, All the Walls We Cannot See. Owning your own home means more than a roof over your head. It means financial security, stability, that warm feeling of accomplishment when you open the door on your very first house and cross into a new world of possibility. Today, home ownership has dropped to the lowest rate in more than 50 years, and first-time buyers are the oldest they've ever been. Mark Barga, a civil engineer from Franklinton, attends a lot of council meetings, and he has an idea about why this is.
I was at Grove City one year, and a developer was bringing a subdivision to council for the first time. It was a packed house, standing room only. A lot of residents were angry. And before the meeting had started, I heard two neighbors in front of me who were talking. One of them asked the other, "How's your son doing?" And the response was that he just graduated college. He got a job in Columbus, but he couldn't afford the rent at any apartment complexes. So he was going to be living in his bedroom that he grew up in. And the other neighbor had said, "Yeah, that's pretty common. My daughter had something similar. She had to live back home for 2 years. Then the meeting starts. They talk about the housing development, and both of them just started complaining about how this was going to drive their home prices down. And I couldn't believe how blind everyone was to the fact that their children not being able to move out of the house and them fighting tooth and nail to make sure their property values remain high are both caused by the same thing, and that's them blocking development.
It's sort of the definition of NIMBY.
Yes. I'm sure a lot of the people that you talk to in this series are going to say that the solution to the housing crisis is to build more housing. And that's not a controversial opinion, but as soon as you point to anywhere on a map where that housing should go, then it becomes a controversial opinion. And then everyone has a lot of opinions about that.
Mark's not wrong. Zoning meetings are a great place to observe people shouting at local officials. And the object of their ire, when it's not the members of their local planning commission, is usually the home builder or the developer. The company trying to, quote, destroy the farmland behind their house by erecting apartments. Vince Squillace is no stranger to those insults. He is the president of VJS, Public Sector Consulting, and the executive director of the Ohio Home Builders Association. Thanks for joining us today, Vince.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So Central Ohio is on track to have more than 3 million residents by 2050. And to keep up with that demand, I've seen different estimates, but we need to be building around 14,000 to 18,000 homes a year. And the reality is most years we fall several thousand homes short. So simply put, why aren't builders meeting demand?
Well, it's somewhat of a complicated subject. I hate to say that.
That's what we're here for.
Well, good. Many don't realize when they go to a model home and visit, look at all the nice features of a home, and then they wonder why the price is so high. What they don't see is the many steps, the very expensive steps that take place even before the home is constructed. And that's a developer or a builder or any group of people who want to get in the business to find land that they can get a permit for a suitable amount of lots on which you can build a home. Oftentimes, that's a very expensive process, sometimes 20, 30% of the final price of the house. So zoning is probably the biggest factor which leads to expensive lot prices. Also, there's another component beyond the development stage, how big a house may be, how large the side of the yard might be, the elevations that have to maybe on the house, if there has to be one or two or three car garages. So there's many, many steps that add to the price of the home that are required from all levels of government, local, state, and national, which contributes to that final price.
I want to break down the cost of building a house for our listeners. So there's those raw materials, which you can't do much about because we're always going to need the bricks and sticks. I want to focus on the costs that we don't see. And the first one is something you just touched on, which I'm going to call general standards. And what I mean by that is minimum lot sizes, height restrictions, lawn requirements, mandatory garages, distances between houses. If you had to ballpark it, how much are those general standards costing us?
I would guess 20 to 25% of the final price of the house.
And some of it's not just so a city or a municipality can have rules, but like certain HOAs have very strict rules, right? They've decided that this area is going to look a certain way.
That's correct. And there's also oftentimes conditions in those HOAs on which there's a homeowners association fee as well, which is in addition to the property taxes that you would pay to your local government, which adds to the carrying costs of just owning the home as well, beyond the purchase price.
And particularly in Central Ohio, lot size can be a big deal because land is precious in a place that is expanding rapidly. So if it's half an acre minimum lot size versus quarter acre minimum lot size versus like a city lot size, I mean, you're getting totally different prices for that land.
Very true. And oftentimes you don't see this as well. A city or a county or the township, whatever the case may be, may give you the density you want and then ask that 25 to 50% of the land be maintained as open space. So all of a sudden you've gone from 2 to 4 to an acre to 1 to 2 to an acre, which adds to the final price of the lot.
What about architectural design standards? Like you have to have brick on the front of the house or this, that, and the other.
Sure. I mean, that, you know, that's a cost as well. There's less expensive materials available for roofing and siding, the number of windows. So all of that goes into the final price. And as we all know, prices are more expensive today than they were 10, 15 years ago. So the more standards that are required, or even the slopes and the shape of the roof and the exterior elevations, also adds to the final price of a house.
I want to drill down on starter houses specifically, because the average size of the American home keeps going up, while the average number of starter houses keeps going down. So I found the statistic that in 1940, 70% of new homes were 1,400 square feet or less. Today, that's about 8%. So why are we building so few starter houses?
Maybe one of the reasons is we no longer recognize that as a need. I remember looking at old home movies. My father was very active after World War II, and I can see pictures of celebrations where cities would build homes for veterans. And they're all smaller homes, but nice homes, you know, compact, but it kept the price down so all the returning veterans from World War II would find a place to live. It seems as though we don't have that sense of urgency anymore for our first time home buyers, you know, our children as they grow up and they venture out. I think it's now a matter of how much tax revenue can we yield from this property, put a minimum burden, and I hate to use that term, burden on society, all these new residents. So no longer is that a priority to house the people who need it the most, and that's the first time buyer.
Yeah, a lot of communities have minimum square footage requirements saying you can't build houses smaller than X number of square feet.
Very true. And that just inflates the price of the house. And if you look at, you know, the homes many of us grew up in, people my age, there are many, you know, 4-bedroom, one bath homes, you know, less than 2,000 square feet. And somehow we all got through it all fine. But nowadays we feel as though we need all this expansive space, when really all that expensive space does is just artificially increases the final cost of the house.
First-time homebuyers used to be 40% of the market. Now they're at 26%, which is the lowest since the National Association of Realtors began tracking that statistic. So I think it's definitely having an impact on the ability of first-time buyers to get into the market.
Without question. I can remember back in 82 when interest rates hit 18%, if you can imagine that. At that time, we helped pass the tax-free bonds for housing. Now, it passed by 65% of the vote, But three prior attempts, it was defeated by 65% of the vote. It was once the people realized that 18% home loans was just too high, we had to find a way to get the price of housing down. So perhaps some of that is going on now, where many of the folks are realizing their children can't afford a place to home to buy a home. Maybe we need to start focusing on the regulatory end of it and how that's making it more difficult to achieve home ownership.
And when it comes to building attached condos, duplexes, multifamily units, the Ohio Housing Finance Agency has this super interesting map that I'll include with the web story that we post about this episode. But the map shows where multifamily dwellings can be built in Central Ohio and where it's zoned single family only. And the big picture is that we have many more square miles where it's single family only. But when you zoom in, like as you head up north on 71 past Clintonville into Worthington, Westerville, Dublin, the map turns almost all single family.
That seems to be the preference that the communities want. Oftentimes they feel like there's a greater tax benefit to the city. There's less of a, again, using the term burden on police and fire and emergency services. It's as if unless you're a certain size home and produce so much tax revenue, we'd rather you live someplace else. I hate to use that term. It sounds kind of harsh. But until we realize there's a need for everybody in a particular community, there's a responsibility of that government to provide some kind of suitable housing for them.
Yeah, I always say you ever want to watch a planning commission meeting get really heated, really angry, watch what happens when people try to build apartments next to single family houses.
Very true. There's, for some reason, there's this mindset that, you know, multifamily housing is going to bring in the type of people we don't want or we shouldn't have, or perhaps it's going to reduce the value of our property. But still, it fulfills a need in the community for the people who are likely to live there. And that type of housing should be embraced and allowed and encouraged everywhere, not only in Ohio, but in all states.
In preparing for this episode, I came across this book called Zoning Rules. It makes the case for something called a zoning tax. So basically, how much regulations add to the cost of a house in different areas. In San Francisco, it estimated that 50% of the cost of the house was the zoning tax. So if you think about that, $1 million home in San Francisco could cost $500,000 in the absence of this zoning tax. Do you have any ballpark figure for what the zoning tax might be in Central Ohio? Like, how much cheaper could that median home of about $300,000 be?
Well, our national association, who has an excellent economics division, has, and we pointed this out to the legislature, that roughly $100,000 of the cost of the new home is due to government regulations.
Oh, my goodness.
A big part of that is zoning, because even though it may be attributable to building and elevation appearances, it's all packed into the zoning. So to get that final approval you need, it all comes under the heading of zoning.
So if things keep going the way they are here in Central Ohio, where we're not keeping up with the demand and we're sort of restricting what can and can't be built, are we headed for a housing crisis? Are we like the next Denver, Colorado?
Well, I think there already is a housing crisis. When you have such a large percentage of people who cannot afford a home, and it is just not in Central Ohio. You know, we represent builders all across Ohio. And we've heard of it from the far corners of Northwest Ohio, where companies wanted to locate a big business, an industrial complex, say, but they can see there's a lack of affordable housing for the workers to live there. So I think there already is a crisis. There's certainly a very grave concern. You may have seen the legislature has already picked up the mantle on this. They realize it's a problem. They're looking for solutions, and it may require some tough acts that local government has resisted in the past, but we just have to find a way to accommodate people who live in our community. And as we make space for them, that's the only way the crisis will be averted or even eased somehow.
Final question. What do we need to advocate for at the local level or the state level if we want to get you guys building more houses?
We need to come up with a set of comprehensive planning that all zoning agencies must adopt that meets certain criteria, one of which is they have to make provisions for the people who are likely to move into that area. That comprehensive plan has to be binding on any rules and regulations that are adopted in foreseeing this movement of people, which will accommodate everything from lower income housing to allowing higher income. So once that's recognized, it's the law of the land, and the cities start accommodating their planning and zoning and subdivision regulations. And that includes the federal government too, who has been increasing building code requirements substantially in the past, all in the name of saving energy. It all goes to making housing more expensive. And there are ways that you can do it through your zoning, planning, and building to decrease the cost of housing to a substantial degree.
That was Vince Squillace, president at VJS Public Sector Consulting and the Ohio Home Builders Association. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Coming up, we're untangling the reasons why we pass those restrictive zoning laws and then fight so hard to keep them. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, and I'm your host, Anna Staver. Zoning laws determine the sizes of our houses, how close together they sit, whether sidewalks are mandatory, what kind of building materials are permitted. These regulations play a major role in the cost of our homes, and in many cases, they also construct invisible walls that keep lower-income folks out. Here to help us untangle how zoning keeps home prices high is Richard Kahlenberg, author of Excluded, How Snob Zoning, NIMBYism, and Class Bias Builds the Walls We Don't See. Welcome to Untangled, Richard.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Anna.
Before we dive into the what, I want to start by understanding the why, the motivation for passing exclusionary zoning. And I think a passage from your book is a great place to start. You write the quote, "As home ownership was transformed from a consumer commodity to an investment, homeowners became increasingly anxious about how new development might impact their property values, and they demanded new zoning constraints." Can you explain that for us?
Yes, I think property values is at the center of these debates. The flip side is property values for one person is the housing affordability crisis for someone else who wants to buy. But the idea is that people place so much of their, so many of their resources into a single asset, which you can't really diversify, a home, and therefore they're extremely nervous about any changes in the neighborhood that they might think negatively affects their property values. Most of the research, in fact, suggests that changes are likely to have very little impact on their home values, but that's what's driving a lot of the concerns.
Yeah, you have some examples in your book, like my home is my retirement account, that it's the majority of wealth for most people, that it's their biggest investment, and they're really banking on that ROI.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, there are other countries where they don't have the same government incentives to concentrate people's wealth on one particular asset. It's kind of a crazy system, but it is the system that we have. And so it's understandable that people are concerned. I think Their concerns are overblown, though. The research suggests that even when subsidized housing is placed in communities, that so long as it's tasteful and scaled properly, there are no negative impacts on property values.
But that fear built the not in my backyard or NIMBY mentality, as we call it. That idea that, sure, we need affordable housing, just not near where I live. I want to bring Mark back again. He's the civil engineer that we had on at the beginning. And here's what he thinks NIMBY means.
I do remember reading something in the Dispatch a few months ago about a woman who lived in Delaware County between the two reservoirs, and she said that if you couldn't afford a 5-acre lot, you were a transient, which I got a very good chuckle out of. So yeah, if you can't afford a 5-acre lot, then they don't want any part of you.
Yeah, that dovetails with a lot of the reporting that we've been doing for this show. American homes are getting larger and larger in terms of square footage, and those 1,000 square foot starter houses, we're not building them anymore.
And some of that is zoning. There's going to be minimum lot size and there's going to be minimum square footage that is required for some of this stuff. Again, like I said, if someone was building a mansion next door, that would be seen as a way to increase your property values. But if they're building condos or a very small house, they might say, well, that's going to be a poorer residence or something like that. And so they just want to block that at all costs. So if you can't get it approved through zoning, no one's going to build it. And so a lot of those smaller houses aren't what the existing homeowners want next to them. So it's written out of the zoning code.
So, Richard, that's the heart of it, right? It's existing homeowners don't want these places next to them, so they write it out of their community's zoning code.
That's right. So part of it is that in many cases they don't want any kind of development. But what's particularly nefarious is when they don't want development that will involve people of more modest means, perhaps people of different races, and that's really where exclusionary zoning started. It started in places like Baltimore, where there was explicit racial zoning. If you were black, you couldn't move into the neighborhood, and property values was one of the things that was cited as a rationale. That's fortunately we've moved beyond explicit racial zoning, but we now have in essence economic zoning to keep people of lesser means out of certain communities. And I think a racist is worse than a snob, but they're cut from the same cloth. The belief is that some people are so beneath others that they should not be anywhere near those more advantaged folks.
And NIMBYism isn't restricted to one political party, right?
Yeah, so this is the was one of the more troubling aspects of the research for me. I consider myself left of center, and so I was very disturbed to find that there's pretty much of a social science consensus that the worst forms of exclusionary zoning are often in politically liberal areas, so along the coasts, but then within states, you will find more exclusionary zoning in more politically liberal areas, and that's connected to education levels today. Those who have higher levels of education tend to be more politically liberal. Didn't always you wasn't always that way, but it is today. And that there is evidence that people with high levels of education actually have less racial prejudice, so that's a positive thing, but have more prejudice towards those with less education and fewer means.
You write that the primary sin of the left is elitism, essentially.
Yes. And the primary sin of the right is racism. So it's not as if there's anyone here who's completely in the clear, but that is something that those of us who are left of center need to recognize and grapple with.
Yeah, I think Boulder, Colorado is actually a great example of this. The community has fiercely resisted the explosive growth that's been happening in Denver and other parts of their state, even restricting basically how much the city could grow year over year over year. And the median home price in Boulder is now $1.4 million. So they have fought that growth tooth and nail, and now it's wildly expensive to live there.
Right. And it's you know, it's simply a matter of supply and demand. So when communities say that we're going to limit growth and that we're going to require, you know, large lot sizes or ban any kind of multifamily housing, that means that there are more people chasing a fewer number of smaller number of housing units. And the result is very predictable. I mean, we saw that during the pandemic when used car prices skyrocketed because there wasn't, you know, there were supply chain issues. And here we have, in essence, a government-created supply issue where, by design, we're making housing more expensive than it needs to be for people.
I loved the analogy in your book where you wrote that it would be like car manufacturers being limited on how many they could sell, and that we should sort of imagine like only 1,000 cars can be sold every year in Ohio. The price of those cars would be well beyond what most of us could afford.
That's right. So people recognize that that would be insane to do. And yet in the housing arena, we give local governments extraordinary power to decide who gets to live in their community and how many housing units are going to be built. And so we've outsourced kind of our system of trying to meet demand with supply to local governments that that perceive it as being in their self-interest to limit supply.
Aside from just affordability, exclusionary zoning has other impacts, particularly when it comes to education, right?
Absolutely. And that's how I entered this this field of housing. I mean, I spent 30 years writing about efforts to try to make opportunity more equal for kids in our schooling. And I kept bumping up against housing policy. Housing policy is school policy because about 3/4 of American school children attend neighborhood public schools. That is a school based on what sort of neighborhood their parents can afford to live in. And so when housing policy creates economic segregation, that results in school segregation, which is really, really bad for, it's bad for everyone, but particularly for low-income students. You know, low-income students who have a chance to attend economically mixed schools or even more affluent schools are as much as a year or 2 years ahead of comparable low-income students who are in high poverty schools. So this has a huge impact on the life chances of young people. And I think, you know, that's just another reason why we need to deal with exclusionary zoning.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the example of the Montgomery County Public Schools? So they gave $2,000 more per pupil to low-income schools. And then in other places, they integrated through affordable housing. So what did this experiment show?
Yeah, they had these two interventions, both of which are backed by research. I mean, they were spending $2,000 extra on good things, like reduced class size in the early grades. And yet over time, the students who, through what's called inclusionary zoning, the low-income students who were able to live in middle-class neighborhoods and attend middle-class schools did far better than the low-income students in high-poverty schools, even though those high poverty schools had the extra resources, the extra $2,000 to spend. And so the math gap between middle class students and low income students in the economically integrated schools was closed by half, and the reading gap by 1/3. And those are
big gains.
That's an effect that's much, much bigger than most educational interventions.
You also had an example in your book from here in Ohio about a mother who ends up in the Gahanna City School District.
That's right. I mean, I one of the actually, Columbus is a big part of the book, and part of it is because there is a special program called Families Flourish that provides the opportunity for single mothers who have young children to move to more advantaged areas. And so I talked to several mothers, including Kiara Cornelius and Tahani, whose last name she asked me not to use, but they saw that their lives were transformed when they had a chance to move from some tough neighborhoods in Columbus to more affluent areas in the suburbs. And in Kiara's case, Kiara Cornelius's case, she was in a part of Columbus where she felt like it wasn't safe for her kids to visit the grandmother who was two blocks away. They would drive rather than walk to get there. And she had a son who has a son who, is gifted, and she wanted the best education for him. And the move to the suburbs really made a huge difference in her life and in her kids' life. And I tell the story in part because, these are people who are just want what every family wants, better opportunities for their kids. And it's just an enormous shame that these invisible walls that we built in more affluent areas typically keep families like Kiara Cornelius's out. And Families Flourish provides kind of a catapult over those walls for a modest number of families, which is wonderful. But we also want to do, take some more systemic steps to tear down those exclusionary walls, I think.
There's also the time impact. So the further away you live from your work, the longer your commute, which means the less time that you have for sports, exercise, cooking dinner, all the things that we do. And what, I don't know if it frightened me, but you had this stat that planners in Dallas are planning for a day when the city sprawls out 100 miles. That
Yes.
is an insane commute.
It is, and no one likes a long commute, but the research suggests it really takes a toll on families. Their higher divorce rates, higher rates of heart attack. There are a whole host of reasons that it's bad for individual families to be pushed out to the periphery to find affordable homes. It's also bad for everyone because it means more cars on the road for longer commutes, which ends up being meaning more greenhouse gases and climate change. So the fact that by design we're preventing builders from constructing homes that are more convenient for workers is bad on so many levels, and has a really damaging impact on individual families as well.
But we don't often talk openly to each other or even to ourselves about exclusionary zoning. It's a hard issue to face that protecting the price of your house might hurt your community as a whole. That's a difficult pill to swallow. And you write that perhaps there's an underlying belief about meritocracy, that poverty is essentially the fault of the poor person.
That's right. I mean, in trying to figure out why we all thankfully recognize that racial zoning is wrong, and yet there's this desire to cling to economic zoning. Some researchers have pointed to kind of a downside to our meritocratic system. Now, to be clear, I'd rather have meritocracy than nepotism or other forms of allocating opportunity. So meritocracy has a lot going for it. But sometimes people who are successful in the meritocracy, as the philosopher Michael Sandel says, they inhale too deeply in that success, and lack the humility to recognize the various ways in which luck play into how they've gotten ahead in life. And the other downside, obviously, is it means that, well, if people did not succeed economically or educationally, then perhaps there's something wrong with them. I hear it all the time when people say, well, the distinction between race and class is that you can change your class and you cannot change your race. And that on one level is obviously true, but poverty is less mutable than we would like to think. And economic position is less mutable. I mean, there's all sorts of research suggesting that children born into low-income families who then grow up in high poverty neighborhoods have nothing like an equal chance to succeed in America.
That was Richard Kahlenberg, Director of Housing Policy at the Progressive Policy Institute and the author of Excluded. Coming up, we're adding a regional planner to our conversation and talking about solutions to exclusionary zoning. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Building affordable housing would go a long way towards solving Central Ohio's housing crisis. But it matters where this housing gets built. Often, the areas where affordable housing goes up are far from reliable services and economic opportunity. Still with me is Richard Kahlenberg, the author of Excluded: How Snob Zoning, NIMBYism, and Class Bias Build the Walls We Don't See. And joining the conversation is Jason Reese, Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning at The Ohio State University. Reese's research seeks to understand the role planning plays in fostering the environments that support a just city and healthy communities. Welcome to Untangled.
Thank you.
Jason, we can't spend an hour talking about exclusionary zoning without discussing government redlining. Can you explain what that is and how it impacted where community of colors still live to this day?
Yeah, certainly. The era of redlining really emerges in the 1930s as the federal government is making this push in response to the Depression to prioritize home ownership. As part of the number of reforms that happened in the 1930s, the expansion of federal backing for mortgages became a primary tool to expand home ownership for Americans. To guide that, they conducted assessments of neighborhoods in almost 230 cities across the country, neighborhood by neighborhood, grading neighborhoods in terms of their likelihood of being a safe or hazardous investment. The term redlining comes actually from the palette used on those maps that were hand-drawn back in the day, with those red areas indicating areas that were to be denied credit because of the neighborhoods being perceived by the federal government as too risky. That would perpetuate through federal policy for decades, leaving a legacy of disinvestment in these neighborhoods for almost a half century.
And later on in this series, we're going to get to the wealth gap and to the gap in home ownership between white Americans and black Americans. But Richard, you had this statistic that was hard for me to stomach. You write that white Americans are willing to pay $48,000 more for a home if it's in a predominantly white neighborhood.
Yeah, it's astounding that to this day, white Americans are willing to pay a premium in order to find a community that is separate and apart from Black people. And that's, you know, it's a residue of the redlining that kept us separated, and so people's attitudes are affected by that. But it's a reality that we have to face head on.
There is some research that perhaps it's not about white versus black, but not wanting to live near lower income people. But I guess either way, wealthy Americans are paying a premium for class segregation in that situation then.
That's right. There are economists at the American Enterprise Institute who went back and forth with the Brookings Institute about whether it's race or class. Either way, it's a disturbing finding.
I actually think that's part of what drives this push for school vouchers, because if public schools were high performing, no matter where you live, I think some of the stigma about where we live would disappear. Does that make sense, Jason?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to factor in schools are a critical part of the equation with home buying as well as in thinking about home values. On the other side of that spectrum as well, and as your earlier guest noted, we have communities that, because of the need of having high property taxes to support school revenues, they're fiscally zoning, right? So they're zoning to get high price points because they need those revenues for the school district. And so equity in terms of school funding becomes a major driver in the background of this issue.
And there's a question I like to ask every guest who comes on to Untangled for this series on housing, which is, do we have a housing crisis?
Well, currently we have about 50,000 people in Franklin County who are paying half of their income or more for their housing. These are folks who are most likely to experience potentially homelessness and displacement. That number goes to 80,000 if we wrap in the other central Ohio counties. I would say if we're not in a crisis now, we're heading towards one. There are estimates, because of the underbuilding in central Ohio, that we could be short of more than 100,000 housing units by 2032.
Richard, on a national level, would you say the country is facing a housing crisis?
Yes, I'd say we're facing multiple housing crises. When people talk about the housing crisis, they typically are talking about affordability, and that's certainly a huge problem in large parts of the country. I think there's also a housing crisis that has to do with, you know, rising economic segregation, which is undermining our democracy and undermines equal opportunity. So I say they're twin crises that we're facing. And I'll just add in terms of Columbus. I mean, Columbus is the second most economically segregated metropolitan area in the country. So if as Jason says, the affordability crisis is coming to Columbus, you've already got the second crisis of economic segregation.
I want to talk a little bit about solutions. And Richard, zoning reform is not enough, right? Simply adding high density housing to suburban neighborhoods, for example, won't solve the high price of housing.
So I would say it's a big piece of the solution, not the whole solution. We definitely need, there's a strong role for government to make sure that those who fall through the cracks are supported. So it's not a deregulation only approach, but the two dovetail. And if we reduce exclusionary zoning, that will make housing more affordable for everyone and reduce the need to subsidize. So I think we have to deal on with both angles, the exclusionary zoning on the one hand, and various exclusionary practices, and the need to support those who are economically disadvantaged to make sure they have the housing they need.
Can you tell us what happened in Minneapolis when a young man named Jacob Frey became the mayor?
Yes, and it is important that he's young because no one knows better the housing affordability crisis than young people in America. Minneapolis had a pretty bad form of exclusionary zoning. 70% of the land in Minneapolis was set aside for single-family homes only, so you couldn't build a duplex or a triplex or any sort of multifamily housing. And Minneapolis decided that This was, this was wrong on a number of levels. They looked at the racial history of single-family zoning. They looked at the impact on affordability, and they made a dramatic change to say that duplexes and triplexes would be legalized throughout Minneapolis, and that there would be, other important reforms, including more of housing, multifamily housing near transit, and changes to the parking requirements. And together, all these things have had an enormous impact. Minneapolis, according to Bloomberg, is the first major city to have tamed inflation. And housing is a huge part of that inflation index. And so that's what the researchers have attributed the change to. The fact that they made housing more abundant brought inflation under control in Minneapolis.
Jason, what do you think would happen if Franklin County or even, central Ohio generally banned single-family zoning?
Well, I think we would certainly see a large increase in our production overall. We'd get denser developments, particularly around our infrastructure. That's really critical from an efficiency standpoint. And I think you would begin to see those numbers begin to decline in terms of housing need. As Richard said, though, we still have to think about other supportive programs. The federal government, primarily supports affordable housing needs through the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Only about 1 in 4 people who qualify for that program receive it because there's not enough funding. And so then you have to look at the layering of other local programs for affordability to make sure that those folks who are not served by the market are still able to get housing. So it is a two-step process. We have to reform our zoning, but we also have to kind of reinforce our ecosystem of affordable housing programs.
I want to bring Mark Barga back into our conversation. He's the civil engineer we heard from at the beginning of the show. He spends a lot of time at public planning meetings for his job, and he says we need to stop prioritizing the cutting of homeowner property taxes if we actually want to get buy-in to build more affordable housing.
I think we need existing homeowners to be tied to the housing crisis. There needs to be some skin in the game for them to want to cooperate and get more houses built. And property taxes are really the only thing that does that.
What do you think of that idea, Jason? That the apartment complex near you is, if you think it's going to lower your property taxes, maybe that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I think if you could structure incentives in that way to provide some benefit, I think that would help. I would add, though, a lot of this is stigma associated with multifamily housing, and in many cases, unearned stigma in terms of the characteristics and quality of most of our multifamily sites across the community. I think we have historical examples of traditional old public housing that resonate through our consciousness today. And so you get this really oversized response to a multifamily apartment, not just because of the fiscal concerns, but because of that stigma that we have as a society in terms of multifamily housing.
And Richard, I want to have this question for you more about. So, zoning regulations are something that's come up in the last 100 years. Ish. So when you go downtown in Columbus, like German Village, there are these very cute little row houses, and they are maybe, 8 feet apart from each other, those very narrow alleyways that are totally not legal to be built now. And I sort of wonder if we need intervention at the state level to bring that back. Sort of, we have a super decentralized approach to housing, right? So Worthington has their own rules, Westerville has their own rules, Columbus, and so on and so forth. And do you think maybe it's going to take statewide zoning laws to make substantive change?
Well, I think statewide interventions can be very important, and we've seen them happen, with a Republican governor in Montana and with Democratic governors in places like Oregon and California. The constitutional authority over zoning is actually resides with the state. The states then delegated to localities the ability to take charge of zoning in their individual communities. And so ultimately, in a place like California, where the housing prices had gotten so high, the state realized it needed to intervene and to override some of the harmful abuses by localities. So localities still have a lot of say in what goes on, but the state tries to curb those particularly egregious practices. And so in Oregon and California, they legalized duplexes and triplexes, basically up to 4 units in California, and then also had important incentives for transit-oriented development as well. So I think that, and this is, I should add, this is an interesting area where liberals and conservatives can come together, because progressives like me care about the social justice aspect, conservatives care about property values, so I mean property rights. And so I think there's real potential.
That was Richard Kallenberg, the author of Excluded. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And
Thanks so
thanks
much for
to
having me.
Jason Rees, a regional planning professor at Ohio State University.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this hour of Untangled on 89.7 NPR News.